Rules to Reality is a podcast that highlights how regulation shapes or fails to shape our daily lives. I'm speaking to you from Wurundjeri country and would like to pay my respects to elders past and present and any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people listening today. I would also like to acknowledge the ongoing role that colonisation and racist regulation has had on First Nations, but also First Nations resilience and survival in continuing to connect and practice the oldest living culture in the world. Today we continue the theme from the last episode with Professor Camilla Nelson about the family court system. In this episode, I interview a young person with experience of going through the family court and child protection system. But Section 121 of the Family Law Act and other laws in the child protection system prevent me from identifying the young person, which is, frankly, absurd. These provisions muzzle young people and prevent them from speaking up about what's happening to them. And instead of protecting children, it protects underperforming child protection and family court systems and officials. I would normally introduce the person here, but instead I will say that the person highlighted all of the value that we don't have in our public debate around the family law, family violence, and child protection systems. They highlighted the impoverished notions of care in the child protection system, how alienated young people are from the decisions that affect their lives, and how much better our public policy would be if they were just given the opportunity and better platforms to share their expertise. So please enjoy this episode, subscribe, and rate the podcast on iTunes or Spotify. All right, well, thanks so much for being here. So as you know, in this podcast, I talk about regulation or how we try to ensure that institutions like courts, schools or hospitals, do what they're meant to do, you know. And talking about the family law system and young people, I guess my question is, are there reasons why regulation or following the rules is important?
I think there's a few reasons. The first for me is that it, from my perspective, it ensures like a minimum standard that people are meeting for children and young people. And that's very important in a world where we really don't follow the institutional the Charter for the Rights of the Child, essentially here in Australia. Mm. I think it's also important because it provides a level of protection for children and young people as vulnerable cohorts, particularly in child protection and, any time they're engaging with practitioners or services or courts or police.
Yeah, 100%. And are you... I suppose is the upshot of that, I mean, you'd see, either yourself or talking to other people that's not the case, like those things aren't actually being followed?
I would say that to some extent it is and to some extent it isn't. Yeah. Like, I think the minimum, the standards that we have and the regulations that we do have don't really provide the sort of protection and the sort of voice needed for children and young people. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, to some extent, they do actually give children and young people, some level of protection again. Yeah. To be able to ensure that they're, taken care of, to the minimum, mm-hmm. Which is, I think it's in the 2005 Children and Families Act that the definition of care is the control and the daily needs of children and young people. That's the definition of care. So which is kind of a bit, that sort control. Of says to some extent what it's about, which is about, controlling and regulating a child's life. Yeah. Which means that there's very little that really needs to go into ensuring that child's care aside from the daily needs. You can omit things what the child wants to know. So you don't have to tell them what they need to know. You don't have to engage with them around sort of even things like probably engaging with family members once they're in out of home care, things like that. So it's as long as you're meeting their daily needs and you're keeping them under control, that's all that really, at least that's what I'm gathering from that, and that's what I've experienced and other young people have experienced coming through the system.
Yeah, that's so full on. Yeah, so, I mean, when you talk about that, it seems like it's a very small world that children and young people are made to live in when they're in that situation, you know, like this controlled world. And, yeah, you know, you get your food and essentials, but, yeah, like that connection to your other family, your spiritual well-being, you know, what you want to do with your life. Doesn't seem like those things are part of the regulatory framework or the minimum standards that you're talking about. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the areas that crops up a lot is the Family Law Act. You know, as you know, it says all decisions must be made in the best interests of the child. You know, is that your experience or the experience of young people that you know or have spoken to?
I would say it's generally not the experience of children and young people like myself and others. Usually they're, you know, like when people talk about, you know, what children need, it's not in the context of talking to them directly. It's in the context of what, you know, people who maybe met that young person once or twice think the child needs. So a lot of the time you're not, you know, you're going into sort of court settings, but you're never going into the courtroom. Someone is talking to you in a room on your own, maybe sometimes with your siblings, and then they're taking what you're saying into a court and you have no idea what the outcome is or what happened with that court case, aside from what your worker tells you when they have to take you away and separate you from your siblings to go into care. So a lot of the time, you know, like you could say that you're looking, you're working in the best interests of the children or the young people that you're working with, but a lot of the time if it's not coming from the children and young people's perspectives, you're not truly meeting their needs or, you know, working in the best interests.
So, I mean, you were talking about, you know, some of the people that you're likely to meet, or you might meet someone once or twice. Am I right that one of those people would be like it's not always the case, but an independent children's lawyer? Are they some of the people that you might end up meeting?
Yeah, independent children's lawyers, also like your child protection worker potentially, who you might have never met maybe once in like 5 years. It's also like magistrates who are making decisions about your life, and also like workers that you had no idea were engaged with your family as well.
That's so wild, hey? I mean, to like, I just, you know, I suppose I'm a bit older and I feel like I'm getting ancient and my hair's falling out actually, but the idea that there would be this whole web of people around my life controlling the different parts of my life, but I don't even know them, that's the stuff of conspiracies. Like I don't want to over dramatize it, but I'm just trying to take what that might look like from the person with the lived experience to have these anonymous people making decisions about them.
It's especially like as a child, like, you know, as a teenager you probably have more awareness going on because you know, once you're in your sort of like 15 to sort of 17 range, you're probably going to see more engagement from like your workers and things like that to get you on track to sort of become independent of things, particularly in out-of-home care. But like, especially like as a young child, probably up to the age of 10, like you're generally not spoken to at all. And generally the only time that you might be spoken to is when some child protection workers come in to speak to you about your situation with your family. Mm. And like in the context of, you know, I'm not sure how it would be now, but in the context of like 2012 and before, like they would just appear at your school. And they'd be like, we need to have a chat with you. And these are people you've never met in your life, but one of them, they all know you. And one of them is usually your child protection worker, and they know everything about you or enough about you to get a grasp on, you know, that there's something not going right with your family.
Yeah, that's so full on. And again, that, I mean, when you talk about things needing to be in the best interest of the child, it's pretty hard to square that with the person's interests as they see them, just not really coming to the forefront. Because what I mean, we might get to this later, but and I apologize for being all bouncy with my conversation. I hope it just makes it more conversational. But it seems like those engagements that get are to get information, but not to find out what the person wants. Is that accurate or
not? Generally, yes. Like from my experience of others, it's more about trying to find out like what the situation with the family is. So asking if, you know, you've been hit, or, you know, what sort of has been said in certain conversations that they may have heard about. So things like that. It's just, yeah, like it's generally not about you as a person, but about your experience in that family.
Gosh. Okay. Well, I mean, that already sort of gives us context for I guess some of the other themes that we'll explore. So I guess the next question I have is, you know, there's rules, regulations and processes. And, you know, in the prelude to this episode, I talk about the fact that one of those rules is that we have to, we can't identify you in this episode. So that's an example of a rule. They often silence young people and don't, and again, this is going to the point we just made, don't treat them as experts. What's your experience or as an advocate in this space or personal in the family law and some of those connected systems that you were talking about?
Pretty bad, honestly. I mean, like as someone who has done, you know, like stuff with the media, like one of the biggest things that comes out is can we actually interview you at all? Mm-hmm. Because of the legal implications of having a previous child protection order on me. And that's the same similar experience for other young people, and some young people, you know, like have been in situations where they've, you know, potentially had to go to court for violating sort of that protection order, despite the fact that they're over the age of 18. Some of the other issues with this is that, I mean, look, like as a young person, when you're going into a courtroom as well, that like when you're actually allowed in your physical courtroom, generally that's only in the context of, you know, custody battles or, you know, as a witness to some sort of violent act or something like that. I was like, I've had an experience where I've been able to like be a witness to an incident. But that was the only time I was ever allowed in the courtroom when it had nothing to do with me. But when it had to do with my own experiences, and this is the experience of a lot of young people, you generally will not be allowed into the courtroom as a young person. Like a solicitor or a, you know, a child lawyer has to go in for you and speak about your experience in your life in the courtroom. And if you do go in, like the experience of other young people has been that the judges have been very dismissive and like basically told them, how dare you speak that way about your parents. You're going to go back to live with them, despite the fact that it's a pretty high risk family violence situation. So, you know, like across the board, like young people aren't listened to and generally silenced, even when they are allowed to speak about their experience.
I couldn't think of anything more. Like, this view, I mean, actually, you are talking about things within the context of family violence, so I can. But there are a few more intimidating things than having a child or young person having a judge tell you off and sort of silence your disclosures of family violence or something like that. Are you what's my question when I think about that? Do you think this is intentional, or do you think it's just a consequence of bias? I'm kind of going down a different lane here, but what do you think when you see the system run like that? Do you think people know they're doing that, or is it a bias or unconscious bias that they're suffering from?
I think it's a few things, and one of it is the bias. Like as a society, I feel like we have this really deeply entrenched view that children aren't people. That they don't have autonomy, that they can't have autonomy, and they don't have the ability to make decisions. They're not fully formed people. So therefore, how could they ever make decisions about their own life? And even up to the age of 18 and into your 20s, that can still be the case. I think people's views on violence towards children are also very biased, like because a lot of people in older generations have grown up, you know, getting the wooden spoon or things like that. So when you go and see, like, or when you go online and you see an article about child abuse, a lot of the comment sections will be filled with people saying, oh, you know, get over it, you'll get tougher from it. Or, you know, coming from the perspective of, like, if I had to suffer that violence, then why should, you know, my children get away with not suffering that, you know?
Yeah.
And then on the other, you know, on the other perspective of things, like, our system, like, our child protection system is built on the oppression of not just, you know, like, children, young people, but, you know, in, like, Aboriginal people and their children with the stolen generation. And then obviously, like, the lost generation, when, you know, you're a single mother, you're having your kids taken away. And in, like, you can see a lot of this through the, the Royal Commission on Institutional Abuse, like, institutional sexual abuse, where, you know, like, there was a lot, like, a lot of damage done, a lot of damage done that was never acknowledged. And we've continued to build up our system based on all of that oppression.
Yeah.
And so that's a big issue as well.
Yeah. So the Royal Commission into, what was it? They always have long names, institutional responses to child sexual abuse. Did it, you're saying that it, because I'm not an expert in that, it did talk about the role of child protection previously, or it can't, or the commission itself was damaging. I just wanted to check that.
It looked at like out of home care, and it looked at obviously churches and things like that as well. Some of the stuff that came out that were like around sort of those homes that like young girls and boys were in, and sort of the experiences that they had in there.
I mean, it is, I mean, what that was like handed down 5 years ago now. And we are still seeing report after report about our child protection and family violence and family law systems saying the same things. So it is disturbing that we still have a long way to go. So I guess obviously at least you'd hope anyway, the family law system, and add to that, if you want, child protection and family violence systems, would make young people safe. You know, is that, you know, is that your experience, or the experience of young people that that you speak to?
I think for some young people, it definitely can make them feel safer. Like, for some young people, you know, they may end up in the custody of a parent who really cares about them, and they can move on, you know, with their life, or they end up in foster care with someone who really cares about them, and, you know, they have a good life. I think, like, for a lot of other young people, it probably fails them. Like, that was specifically, like, my experience and the experience of others, where, you know, you get placed back with perpetrators of family violence, or you end up with a court order that's telling you that you have to see the perpetrator, you know, like, maybe 3 times a week, and hearing from other people, they've had to take their children kicking and screaming to go see that perpetrator who's then hurt them while they were there, and there was nothing they could do about it because it was court mandated, so they had to take their children into these situations where they knew they were going to get hurt. I think it's also, like, I mean, in terms of, like, things like IVOs, generally children aren't included on them.
Yeah.
At least that's from what I've heard. So probably better to follow that up. Yeah. But, you know, like, I think it's, you know, like, children are generally treated as secondary victims in family violence contexts as well. So usually when you're, you know, like, you're not really seen as a victim. You're not seen as someone who was at risk at all. And in the context of people I know, usually you're not a witness, you're physically being hurt by the perpetrator. Like, regardless of whether it was an act of revenge from the perpetrator to the mother or whoever the primary parent is, or not, like, it's still violence towards that child, and it's not seen as violence. And when you're talking about out-of-home care, you it's not a safe place to be. Like, if you get into a foster care placement or a kinship placement, you may see the possibility of, like, you know, recovering and being able to move away from sort of the family violence that you experienced, or the abuse that you've experienced. But with kinship care, sometimes the people that you're placed with will be the people who hurt your parents.
Yeah.
And so they're just, you know, they're replaying that again with you as the child, who's, you know, in that kinship care placement. And the same could be said, like, for foster care, where it's not so much obviously that family connection, but sometimes you can be placed with a foster carer, and because the foster carer, you know, has like there's less much more hands off than normally, like with residential care, you can see lots of abuse happening there, but no action on it, because a lot of the time, what you say to your worker will get back to your carer, and then you're in for more pain, essentially. And with residential care, it's that cross, you know, cross contamination of like that's probably a terrible word to use, but like usually you're going into a placement with people who have addictions, have severe criminal records, or like commit crimes, are part of like youth gangs potentially, and are generally, you know, like, and it's not their fault to begin with. Like they went through a severe, terrible experience, and they're in these situations now where like there's just no going back because the system hasn't helped them. And you end up going into those placements and you either join them or you don't, and you end up in a much worse place, not doing what they want you to do, essentially.
And I mean, it sounds obvious, but it obviously isn't obvious to a lot of people, but that their outcomes or the decisions would be different in where you go and whatnot, and it wouldn't solve everything, but if it was more grounded in the Convention of the Rights of the Child, i.e. the child is, you know, an active participant in that decision making process, right? Like so many of these situations, if I'm right, could be averted. What's your reflection on that?
I think that's definitely true. It will definitely help. But I think at the same time, a lot of the issues with our systems like need to be changed from like the ground up, essentially. Like they just needs a massive overhaul. Because even if you did say like, this is what we're going to do, we're going to, you know, ground absolutely everything in the Charter for the Rights of the Child. You're still like, this is the issue. Like you're still going to see like blockages with the system, like the whole way through, because of the funding partly, but also because of the systems and processes that are already in place and the unwillingness to change as well from a lot of people working in the sector.
What kinds of stuff, what kinds of stuff like would be some of those, like just an example of some of those blockages, and maybe the unwillingness to change, just to give the listeners a bit of an example in your mind?
I think funding is one of the major ones. Like I think when you're talking about, you know, like, I mean, with the Royal Commission into Family Violence, there's been a lot of change made, a lot of recommendations, like all of them were taken on. But because of the lack of funding for services and the lack of resources has meant that like, even if you have these new services in place, you're not really seeing much change because you're just, it's creating this massive, like, you know, block of like people, like, so you're just trying to push people through this service, but then the resources are being taken from the other services that need to then the people need to move on to, essentially. So it just becomes really difficult, I think, for anyone to do much when you're addressing one part of the system but not the other, which is the funding. And then the other part of it is that like hearing from people, it's more workload, essentially, to be talking to children and young people. Specifically when you're talking about risk assessments and other things, like they just, people don't want to do it because they don't have the time for it. Despite the fact that it means an escalated risk for that child or young person, because you know, like, you don't actually know if the perpetrator for the child is actually the mother or a sibling.
And I mean, in some of those cases, the failure to spend time at the beginning probably means a, and that's not why you should do it, but it would probably mean a lot of work at the back end when things escalate and, you know, there's a lot of fallout, I imagine. You've laid it out really powerfully there, and just hearing you talk, it really highlights the issues to me about not enabling young children and young people to speak openly on these issues. How much better would our public policy be for more people in your position to be able to speak openly about this? Because I'm, as you can tell from a lot of the questions, I'm not even getting the questions right, and that's partly because we don't hear enough, you know, from
from people with lived experience of going through the system. So I just want to kind of reiterate that. But from that expertise that you're talking about, what do you think, and this is about having a voice, but please expand it just to improve the system, because, you know, I don't want to be too narrow, but what more can be done to allow young people to have more of a voice in the system, a say in their lives, safety at home?
There's probably a lot there.
Yeah.
I think the first thing is better data collection and sharing. I think there's, at least like from what I've read up and what I've looked at, there's not a lot of data that really tells you exactly what's happening for children and young people in family violence contexts, particularly like the deaths of children. And this is like a big issue because, you know, like, and it's like on statistical like websites, they've also said that, like, you know, like we can't really know the full extent of it. But some of the issues are that we don't know how many children are dying from family violence every single year. It's not a recorded statistic in the same way that how many women are dying each year is.
I didn't know that. Okay. Yeah.
You can't really, like, the only place that I've seen any sort of real statistics have been on like news articles or during the Safe Steps vigil that they have every year, where they list the children, but they can't name them, obviously. And that's, I guess, another issue. But like, I also understand the safety concerns around that as well. Some of it is also the way that we sort of, I guess, do coroner's reports as well, because a lot of the time when a coroner's, at least like from what I've seen, a coroner report comes out, but it generally won't tell you like much about the experiences leading up to the potential death of that child. And, you know, like particularly when you're talking about children and young people who are known to child protection, there should be a lot of data there, really. You don't hear about how many children die in care either. At least that's not something that I've seen, and I'm an advocate. In terms of other ways, like, because like I think that's the fundamentals, because once you start knowing the data, then you can start sort of, you know, like really seeing where things need to change.
It's an accountability mechanism, isn't it? You know.
Yeah, very much so. And like, I think there's a big lack of accountability in systems, or it's usually the people who are on the ground that tend to end up having to take the responsibility for an organization or fail, essentially. But once you have that data, like that's a big help. Like that's one step closer to sort of understanding the issues for children and young people. But then I think in order to really understand that data and in order to actually see change and the voices of children and young people sort of in policy and in regulation and procedures, like you need to actually partner with children and young people. And some of that can be, like, you know, where it's possible. I don't think it, like, you know, if the system lacks the framework to do it a specific way, then that needs to change, obviously. But there are times when you can still include the voices of children and young people without having to, you know, like, completely overhaul the system. But I do believe that you should. I believe that working with children and young people from the very beginning of a project all the way through to the end is one of the best ways that you're going to see, you know, like the voices of children and young people being heard and acted on. So, you know, if you're going to, you can't just bring a young person in midway through and go, what do you think? But it's like, it's halfway done. And then you might have to end up completely going back to the start and redoing it, but most people probably wouldn't. I think employment is a really important thing. So children and young people have a lot of expertise. Or at least, like, if you're talking about employment, young people have a lot of expertise that they can provide, a lot of lived experience that can help improve the way that organizations and the system works with children and young people. And like, employment is like really important for children and young people, because it means that we have some level of independence as well. You know, and that we're not doing things for free. Because in any normal paid job, you wouldn't be doing anything for free. And that's the same with, like, when you're talking about, like, currently in the system, like we're seeing some of that sort of shift as well. So like more young people, like over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, are being able to sort of be paid advocates, and sometimes working at the state level. So that's, you know, that's some really important work. And that's places where, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, you wouldn't see children and young people being able to express their views on the system and the things that, you know, the regulations that are helping protect them. So yeah. I think overall it's just all about, you know, including young people at every step of the way if you're creating something.
Yeah.
And if you're talking about, like, even, like, and part of, like, hearing more voices of children and young people who can't engage at the advocacy level is about including children and young people in legislation changes, because that's the way that you're going to, you know, see more voices being included.
Yeah, I have in the back of my mind that legislation is either due for review, or the Children, Youth and Family Act legislation maybe due for a review sometime soon.
I think it is. Like, and that's another issue, because I'm fairly certain, like, I've heard that, like, some of the reforms are already happening around that.
Yeah.
But as children and young people, we haven't been able to be directly involved, so they've had to do it, like, they've potentially had to talk to us in ways that meant that they could get our views, but we weren't aware that they were using it for something like that. So, and look, that's like government processes, and it's a bit frustrating, but at least they're trying to some extent. So yeah
it's interesting though when you say that, because it is I definitely don't want anyone to misinterpret the point I'm about to make, which is in mental health, it is by no means perfect, and I don't want anyone to come away with that conclusion. There are far more mechanisms for people with lived experience to influence that process than what you're talking about here. Obviously the laws involved have something to do with that, but I think the same kind of stigma that can make us not listen to, I think I've told you I've got my own lived experience of mental health issues, but the same stigma around mental health issues applies, and possibly is even much more unaddressed, to young people not being seen as relevant to policy or decision making. And what I've seen is that young people, to the extent that we hear from them, it's about their quote unquote story, but not, they're not part of the policy decision making process.
Yeah. And look, like, and there are a lot of organizations that definitely try and include children and young people in some of that, you know, policy making and you know, at the advocacy level.
Yeah.
But there's just a lot of limitations around laws and regulations that make it very hard for children and young people to be able to participate fully in a lot of that stuff. Again, I think it comes back to a lot of, like, the devaluing of experiences of children and young people, because they're not, you know, full people, or they're you know, developmentally not ready.
Yeah. And we've heard things to that effect. So you've made a series of compelling cases in this. But what's one thing that, so we've spoken about what needs to happen to change the system in general, but we've got listeners here, you've got their ear. What's one thing that you want them to go away and do after hearing you talk today?
Can I mention a few things?
Yes, of course.
I think if you're a practitioner, like, working with children and young people, I think it's important to look back on your own sort of work and the children and young people you've worked with, and then take what you've learned from that experience and see how you can sort of develop ways to engage with children and young people better and in a context that works for you, because it's not always going to be easy to sort of make big changes with speaking to children and young people in an organization where, you know, you may not be, you know, like, at a level that you can do it, but, like, there are small changes that you can make, maybe around even the way that you risk assess a child or a young person, that could really make the difference for a child or young person to be heard and for them to be safe.
Yeah.
I think it's also important to read a lot of submissions from children, like, from children and young people, or youth groups and organisations that work with children and young people. So, like, I'm pretty sure that there's been submissions into the youth strategy, but there's also been submissions into the homelessness inquiry, as well as the Mental Health Royal Commission from various youth groups.
Mm-hmm.
And, looking at their recommendations specifically, there's probably a lot that can be taken from that that can help improve the way that we work with children and young people.
Yeah.
And I think the other one is like taking the opportunity wherever you can to speak to a child or young person about what they want and, you know, what their experience is, if they're comfortable, so that you can better, you know, better improve your practice for the next time that you engage a child or young person.
That's I love that you were able to, because each one of those are kind of somewhat apply to different people. And so I hope for those people listening, you take that on board. I'll put a, with the help of my interviewee, I'll put a range of submissions from young people in all young people's organisations in the show notes. But I just want to thank you so much for talking today.
Cool. Thank you.